The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from the WGBB studios in Merrick, New York, this is Sports Talk New York.
Good evening and welcome to Long Island's WGBB Sports Talk New York, 95.9 FM, 1240 AM. I'm your host, Mike Guidone, joined as always by the man we call Cappy, Chris Caputo. 516-623-1240 is the number if you want to join in. Again, that's 516-623-1240. Have a huge dose of Knicks, talking a little Mets, NFL draft will be sprinkled in there, but we will be very happy to be joined in just a moment by Mike Vaccaro, veteran New York author and New York Post writer. He'll be talking about his new book, Bosses of the Bronx, The Endless Drama of the Yankees Under the House of Steinbrenner. But before we get to that, I'd like to welcome in again my friend, my cohort, my co-host, Cappy, Chris Caputo. Cap, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, Mike. Glad we're back in the studios.
Yes, absolutely. And we got a lot to talk about, but very excited to bring on Mike Vaccaro, the author of the book, as I mentioned before, Bosses of the Bronx, The Endless Drama of the Yankees Under the House of Steinbrenner. Mike, welcome aboard. Mike and Chris here on Long Island. How you doing
really
tonight?
I'm going to defend
you. Guys, how you guys doing tonight?
Oh, we're doing great. You know, we're very happy to have you on. It's a great time of year, and you have a wonderful book out about the New York Yankees. Again, as baseball is kind of getting into full swing here, nothing better than talking about the Yankees in your book. So if you could just fill us in, tell us, you know, you've been writing about New York sports for a very long time. How this book came about at this point and you know, where it's going from here.
You know, guys, I hear from a lot of your Yankees fans, and I don't think a lot of them remember what George was like when he was really George. You know, they weren't old enough to remember that. A lot of their their older brothers and their fathers, they don't remember it either because they choose not to. Because what they remember is the George that would walk into Yankee Stadium as an older man and be celebrated and cheered. And of course, 10 years later, he'd walk into the stadium and there'd be a lot of loud noises too, for a different reason. And I just wanted to kind of just, there's a lot of stories to tell about that, about him. A very interesting life, no doubt. A lot of different facets to that life, and certainly where they're being preserved between the pages of the covers of a book.
Mike, if people are reading the book, you know, they're looking at the George days versus now the Hal days. Can you talk a little bit about the difference between the two?
Well, they're night and day. You know, George was over the top. He was impatient. He was flamboyant. Whatever the opposite words for all of those descriptions are, that's Hal. He's very patient. He's very careful. You're not going to see him on the back page a lot, certainly not by his own choice. And that's really where Hal is now. And I think sometimes that's to the frustration of Yankees fans. But honestly, look, I mean, you know, George went 18 years one time without winning a World Series because he was too impetuous. He was too impatient. He was always firing managers. He was always getting rid of players. And, you know, Hal is the exact opposite. People are frustrated because they haven't won a championship since 2009. But, you know, honestly, the Yankees are there every year. And I think Hal's got is a big reason for that.
So, Mike, George Steinbrenner buys the Yankees in 1973, pays a little under $9 million, and takes over the team from CBS. Was there any indication at that point what type of owner he was going to be? And you know, did he kind of have or did the fans or anybody have any kind of inkling of what kind of hands-on, you know, demanding boss he was going to be?
You know, it's funny, on the first day he had his, he owned the team. He said he was playing absentee ownership. And, you know, they weren't going to stick to building ships. They weren't going to do anything. They didn't know what to do. I meant baseball. Of course, you know, as he said it, he knew he didn't mean it. And he admitted that to me many years later. But, I mean, you know, what he saw with the team was an opportunity to take advantage of an incredible history, an incredible tradition, and New York City. And, you know, the most important brand in baseball and sports is one of the more notable brands in the world, really. You can go on the streets of Beijing and you're going to see people wearing Yankees hats. And clearly what he was, you know, buying when he bought the Yankees was this worldwide brand and this important brand, and that's what he helped build over the course of his 37 years of ownership.
We're talking with New York Post columnist and author Mike Vaccaro about the book, The Bosses of the Bronx. Mike, George Steinbrenner had kind of like that fan side to him that maybe overruled some of his rational side. Was there something that you couldn't leave out of this book that you had to tell that maybe was a little bit over the top?
I think almost all the over-the-top stories are in there, guys, and there were a lot of them. You know, one of the things about covering George is that, you know, you cover certain teams and you think, oh, my God, that's the biggest meltdown in team history. And, you know, around the Yankees in the Steinbrenner years, you know, that was considered Tuesday. You know, just business as usual. But you're right. There was definitely a duality to George. I mean, there was the George Steinbrenner who was ahead of his time in terms of building, you know, infrastructure, in terms of wanting to put money behind his farm system, investing in scouts, the very best scouts. And that was important. But he kind of shared co-ownership with George Steinbrenner, who was ever impetuous, ever impatient, ever willing to do just, you know, crazy things. You know, hiring Billy Martin five times is a crazy thing. You know, the coddling of young players that he traded in the 80s, it's a crazy thing. And that's, you know, that version of Steinbrenner almost always got the better of the smart version.
Was it always understood, Mike, that both Hal and Hank would take over, or was there ever a question that once George was gone that the team might go in a different direction, or was it always understood that it was going to stay within the Steinbrenner family?
Well, he was always going to keep in the family, you know, over the course of time, because certainly Hal, who George really kind of figured from an early age was going to be the guy that would take over. You know, he wasn't old enough, experienced enough, so over the course of time, he had a couple of son-in-laws, Steve Schindel and Joe Malloy. Of course, they made the career suicide decision of divorcing the Steinbrenner sisters, so they were out of the picture after a while, but he was always going to be Hal. Even Hank, Hank was very much like his father, but, you know, Hank was very reluctant to take over the team when George was suspended in 1990. It just wasn't for him, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He spent a lot of time enjoying the perks of being the guy people called, because he was always fast with a quote, always fast with an opinion. But even he retired of that fairly quickly. Hal was always the guy. Hal was always going to be the guy. And, you know, George saw that from an early age in Hal. He realized that this is a guy who's very different from him in personality and approach. And he always thought that was probably for the best.
Mike, from idea to final writing of the book, how long did it take you to write this book?
It's about 2 years. I mean, the research took about a full year, and the writing took a little, you know, you include that in there. And then the rewriting and the editing and the, you know, trimming it from, you know, into a manageable length took about another 6 months. So it was about 2 years from start to finish.
In those 2 years, Mike, you know, obviously I'm sure you interviewed so many people about this book. Was there any former player of the Yankees or former executive coach, what have you, that kind of surprised you with what they talked about in terms of the Steinbrenner family, or was it pretty much down the line that you expected?
But the way I decided to do this was, I was able to do a lot of the primary reporting on my own just because of my day job.
Right.
You know, I've covered the Yankees almost 30 years now. And so I had those relationships. I had a relationship with George himself. I've had a relationship with Hal for many years. But look, when you want to go back to the older stories, you know, which is before my time when I was a kid, I obviously wasn't around for those. But I, you know, through research and through, you know, a lot of just legwork and reporting, you're able to kind of unearth sort of the stories behind a lot of the stories people have heard about.
Mm-hmm.
But when I would talk to some of the principals, I told them from the beginning, you know, I'm going to talk to you on background. I don't necessarily need fresh quotes from you about things that happened 35 years ago, because honestly, the way I've discovered it is that most people, their memory isn't as good now as it was 35 years ago.
Right.
It just wasn't. And so, you know, for a lot of the guys, I just said, look, just keep me in the right direction if I'm wandering off script here, because something you say you can fundamentally say did not happen. It was a way that I wrote it. And I didn't get any of that. And that's, you know, that was the important thing to me, was telling these stories and telling them right, and, you know, allowing these guys to talk to me on background. I mean, really, you know, I allowed them to make sure the story was told properly and without too many errors. I don't think there are any, but I'm pretty comfortable with everything that's in that book.
But I think, Mike, it also shows the respect that the players, both former and present, have for you being a part of this organization, that they gave you everything you needed.
Well, it's like and also the respect they have for George. Look, George is a very loyal guy. A lot of these guys, after they were done, used to work for George, you know, whether it's spring training instructors or, you know, secondary or tertiary roles in the organization. And, you know, George was good to a lot of these guys. Not all of them. You know, some of these guys, you know, a lot of the guys that he wound up warring with on the back page, you know, he wound up being their employer later on because he really wanted to take care of them.
Do you think that people remember George more for ripping people and the behind-the-scenes crazy stuff, or for the way that they could just walk into his office and have a conversation about what they need?
I don't think they remember the crazy stuff all that much, to be honest with you, which is part of the reason why I wrote the book. You know, I think a lot of people forgot, you know, just how over the top he was for a lot of his tenure. I think they tend to remember the latter day George, and why wouldn't you? Because, well, that's when the Yankees started to win again. And
right,
that's what people want to embrace. And that's why you hear all the time now when the Yankees go on a 5-game losing streak, you know, what would George do if he's still alive? You know, maybe he fired everybody, maybe he traded everybody, but I don't necessarily think that would be the best path, because, you know, there's this mythology that's built around him that if he would snap his fingers, fire some people, and trade some people, and they'd win the World Series. Well, that never happened. It never happened.
Right.
And in fact, the Yankees didn't become the Yankees again until after he was suspended. Gene Michael was able to run the organization without interference from an impetuous owner. And that's part of the record. And look, the first time they built a champion in the 70s was the same thing. George was suspended, and Gabe Paul was given free reign to build those Yankees, too. I'm not taking anything away from George, who was always the big boss, and who was always signing the checks. But the record shows that the Yankees were helped Paul when he wasn't a daily part of the operation.
Once again, we're speaking with Mike Vaccaro, the author of Bosses of the Bronx, The Endless Drama of the Yankees Under the House of Steinbrenner. And, Mike, you know, as you were speaking before and saying about how loyalty was so big with George and within the family, and how so many former players and, you know, people just wound up being employed by George and the team itself. Correct me if I'm wrong, you wrote this book in a style of telling, you know, lots of stories that any baseball fan or any sports fan could really understand and follow, as opposed to just, you know, someone who is, you know, a diehard Yankee fan. Is that correct?
I want to be part of it.
Look, I mean, I think that what Yankees fans look at George, they look at him as a guy who cared so much about winning that he was willing to do anything. I think when they look at Hal, sometimes they look at his lacking those essential elements. But, you know, I mean, George was a colorful guy. He was an over-the-top, interesting guy. Hal isn't quite so interesting. I mean, you know, if you're going to write a book about Hal, it's probably going to be what this book is, which is about 40 pages worth of a 340-page book.
Yeah.
But, you know, look, I mean, I think the fact of the matter is that, you know, the Yankees became the Yankees again because of George. I mean, because of his belief the Yankees could rise from the ashes of the early 70s, and they did. And for the rest of his time as the Yankees owner, you know, they mattered. They were important. They didn't always win. You know, they didn't win championships every year, but they were always a team people cared about, wanted to talk about, and they were always fodder for the back pages of the newspapers.
Mike, who was the best interview that you had for the book that you got something out of that maybe you didn't expect to get?
Well, look, I talked to Hal for a long time in the book. He's very honest. He filled in some blanks about his father. He filled in some blanks about his own, you know, background. And he was very honest about where the Yankees are, where, you know, who they want to be. You know, and was very adamant about how much he cares about winning, and even as much as father does. I know it's not necessarily the way a lot of Yankees fans look at it, but it's absolutely the truth. I mean, he burns doing even as much as his old man did.
Seems like the books are doing well, that you had another set that were printed, correct?
Yeah, it's gone pretty well. I mean, it's been received very well. People like the book. I mean, like, I had a lot of fun doing it. People had a lot of fun reading it. And, yes, it's done pretty well. I'm very pleased about that, very proud about that. And I'm happy, you know, there's been a lot of good word of mouth, so I think people are passing the book around a little bit, too. So it's been good.
That's great to hear. Mike, is St. John's basketball another passion of yours besides the Yankees?
I've been a St. John's fan since I was 12 years old. Yeah. So, yeah, it's great to see them where they are. It's great to cover them relevant again, you know. St. John's is a funny kind of team, you know. So you either cover them a lot or you ignore them because, I mean, if they're not doing well, they're kind of relevant to the New York landscape. It's always better when they have when there's a reason to cover them.
Oh, without a doubt. Do you feel, you know, obviously you've seen college basketball in all its forms. Do you feel that it can continue as currently constituted with NIL out of control, or is it something that's eventually going to have to be reined in?
I mean, I think it's got to be reined in eventually. I just don't see how this can keep growing the way it is. You know, where we're now, you know, players are regularly getting $6 and $7 million a year. I mean, where's that money come from? And how long are people going to be willing to support that? You know, it's a year-to-year thing. Maybe the bigger schools will always be able to do that. I don't know. But I think it needs to be reined in. But look, I'm also not somebody who's going to tell somebody that there should be a cap on how much they're able to make. So, you know, if people are willing to pay these kids $6, $7, $8 million, then God bless.
Again, we're talking with Mike Vaccaro from the New York Post. Mike, you have a Long Island background. We're here on Long Island. How did you kind of go from West Hempstead Chaminade High School to where you are now? What was the path?
Yeah, I knew I always wanted to write. I knew I always wanted to cover sports. And, you know, I went to St. Fondament University to pursue that. I had a lot of opportunity there. And look, I mean, I probably graduated from school with a little bit of ability, a little bit of ambition, and then you have to just get your foot in the door and hope that the dice rolls properly for you. And that's really what happened for me. I mean, I was a beneficiary of a lot of, you know, fortunate breaks, a lot of fortunate opportunities, and, you know, one thing led to another, and here I am at the Post, which is the job I really always wanted to be, because I was always a Post sports section reader, and just kind of dreamed about working here someday, and that's what happened. It's an amazing story when I think about it. I try to think about it too much because I think maybe it'll all go away if I think about it too much.
Obviously, media has changed so much, you know, since you started to now, and we could spend an hour alone just on Twitter and sports media and social media in its own. What would you? I mean, this is kind of a standard question, but if you had a youngster who was looking to get into, you know, sports writing, both Chris and I are educators and teach high school. What's the first thing, or what would you say? Where do you start now with your interest and your desire to be a journalist within sports?
Look, read everything you can, and I mean everything. Read the newspaper, read the magazines, read everything you can online, read books, you know, until your eyes burn. You know, good writing is a product of reading well, and you know, writing is a muscle, and so is, you know, the fundamentals of writing is reading and having an understanding of the written words. And as long as you can write cogently, and as long as you can write, you know, declarative sentences properly, better than anybody else, you're gonna do okay. And that's an important fundamental. And you know, I hear that to kids all the time when I talk to them.
Is there one author, sports related or not, who kind of inspired you?
Jeff Anthony was a really, you know, obviously his work is speaks for itself, but he was also a very generous guy among young writers. I became friends with him, but even before we were friends, he was really a guy who, you know, willing to spend time with me and encourage me, and you know, I wasn't the only one. He did that to a generation of young writers, and you know, a lot of us who write books now, you know, you'll see a lot of John Feinstein in our acknowledgments because he meant that much to us.
Yeah, great writer. Loved always reading all of his college basketball stuff, things like that. If you were to describe in one word Hal and one word George, what word would you use for them?
I'm sorry, you cut out there. One word to describe?
George and one word to describe Hal. What would it be?
George is demanding, almost to a fault. Hal is patient. Look, I mean, and I think that's, you know, some people think that's a fault. I think it's actually one of his greatest strengths, is his ability to keep things in perspective and understand that the Yankees are going to be fine, and the Yankees are fine. Sometimes the ball doesn't bounce the right way in the postseason. It's just the reality of it. Look, the Dodgers postseason is an infallible team, and they should have lost the World Series 3 different times last year. That's the way baseball is.
You know, sticking with the same general manager and even the manager for a long period of time kind of goes along with that patience word. You know, what's it been like to, for the last, let's say, 15 years or so, watch this Yankee team? Because a lot of people this year thought they should make wholesale changes, and they kind of so-called, quote-unquote, ran it back. You know, what's it been like to see the consistency amongst the Yankees?
Look, I think it's smart. They win 94, 95 games every year. You know, ask your Met fan friends how they, you know, how easy that is to do. You know, and if they would sign up for that. I mean, it's not, you know, I don't like when people call Yankees fans spoiled, but I think they're spoiled in the sense that they don't realize that just being in it every year is a good thing. And it's just the nature of the game now. I mean, you need to win 11, sometimes 12, sometimes 13 games in order to win a championship. Now it's different. It's a different pursuit. And look, I know, I get it. The Dynasty Boys of the 90s and early aughts, they won three series also, but that was a special group, and you're not going to see their likes again. It's not easy. It's not easy to survive a baseball postseason, and only the really special teams do. But you can still be a very good competitive team, and you want to hit it. And the Yankees are in it every year.
Yeah, definitely. Certainly in it every year. Looking at this year, Mike, do you feel once everyone is back, you know, Gerrit Cole and the pitching staff and the way the team is gelled, can they be a serious World Series contender?
Of course they can. I mean, they're going to have a great pitcher go out every once everybody's healthy, they're going to have a great pitcher every day. And that's especially going to be helpful not only down the stretch, but also in October. And so I think that's a huge benefit to have that not every team has. And then you just wait and see how the games play themselves out in October. But I think they're going to be in a great position to be able to do some pretty great things in October.
Mike, what's the best part and the toughest part of your job following the Yankees around?
Right here. Well, it's just, you know people are going to read it because people care, you know. Mm-hmm. And I guess the answer is the same way the other day. You know people are going to read it, so they're going to care. So you're going to hear from them. If they disagree with you, you'll hear a lot of that. That's good, though. I mean, I always love to hear feedback about whether people like my stuff, don't like it, don't agree with it. That's the reason why I do it. You know, I deal in opinion. That's my commerce.
Right.
Is sports opinions, and sometimes people will agree, sometimes they won't. But that's all part of it.
We know you just finished this book, and it's out again. You know, wherever books are sold, Amazon. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but is there another book that's kind of percolating in the back of your mind going forward?
Yeah, there's a couple of ideas back there. I'm not sure exactly where it's going to go, but hopefully I'll have an announcement soon. We'll see.
That sounds good.
I'll alert you guys when I reach that conclusion. I promise.
We appreciate that.
As far as going forward right now with the Yankees, do you think that's the right approach going with the patient Hal, or do you think they need a little bit more of that demanding George?
I think demanding George is the reason why they went 18 years without a championship. I get it. People want to ascribe George to have these magical powers, but he didn't have them. You know, it was patience that built the Yankees after George was suspended the second time. I think it's patience that they're going to deliver them again. And patience yields 95 wins every year. I don't see why anybody has to apologize for that. I really don't.
One more on the book. For Yankee fans that are out there, tell us why they need to read this book, Bosses of the Bronx. You've kind of given us a lot in the last 20 minutes, but if they're going to pick up this book, what are they going to get from
it? So, I just think it fills in a lot of blanks for a team that's very interesting, a legacy that's very interesting, and you know, look, I mean, there's a lot of stories to tell, and I tried to tell them, you know, and if people want to hear them because people care about the Yankees. And look, I think the biggest thing you'll see when you pick up the book is that there's a lot of laughs in there. I think it's a very funny book. I don't think I'm necessarily a very funny guy writer, but look, I had an incredible subject that allowed, you know, for a lot of fun, a lot of humor, and I think that all over the book.
Well, you do. You have two struggling Met fans right here, but I can guarantee you we are both going to read this book because we're always interested in dynasties and in great teams. Teams, you know, you think Yankees, Dallas Cowboys, all that. They're just a brand unto themselves. But it sounds like it's going to be a great read. We wish you all the best. Can't thank you enough for joining us tonight. And once again, it's Bosses of the Bronx, the endless drama of the Yankees under the house of Steinbrenner. Mike Vaccaro, thanks so much. Good luck this year. Stay well, and look forward to talk to you again at some point.
Guys, thanks for all the time. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So once again, Mike Vaccaro, he was great. You know, it's I know he. It sounded like he was at work, actually. I think there was a lot going on in the background. He's probably
first loss for the Yankees in 9 days down in Houston. But yeah, I'm sure you're out and about. Sometimes you got to take a phone call while you're still working, and you're going to hear some of that stuff in the background. So if that's what you heard Mike Vaccaro, New York Post, talking about his book. And, you know, I think he's right. The definition of the Yankees changed when it went from George to Hal, but the success didn't.
Right.
And that's because they make sure that they put a winner on the field each year. Now, it's not winning necessarily in championships, but you're getting a over 500 team.
Absolutely. That's at least always in the discussion. And, you know, the one thing, Chris, that kind of fascinated me as he was talking and here towards the end is he's mentioning about how this book is funny and with the stories. And you don't think comedy too much when you think of George Steinbrenner, although I don't know if you've ever seen it. He actually hosted Saturday Night Live.
Yes, remember that.
Yeah, and it was pretty funny. But I'm any sports book you throw in front of me, I'm going to read it. But this really sounds interesting to me to you know, see some of the lighter side. And he did mention that he's did he use the term friends with Hal Steinbrenner? It seemed like he's pretty tight with him.
It sounds like he's able to get an interview or sit down and talk. You know, that's the one thing I wonder about these guys, you know, when they're on the road and they're covering these teams. Like, is it friendly? Is it, you know, professional, but still, like, you know, Kevin Burkhardt, I think, was friends with David Wright.
Yes.
You know, Steve Gelbs is friends with other broadcasters, but is he friends with some of the Mets? I don't know. Will they go out on a road trip? Probably at some point. But I think with an owner, that's a totally different different mantra.
It is. I was going to use I was going to say Mike Vrabel, but you know, that's a whole nother story. But I mean, and you can get into the ins and outs and the ethics of writers and what's appropriate. I mean, that's a whole nother story. Sure. But I think that I would definitely be fascinated to know. I think back to the stories of Billy Martin, and he was very friendly with a lot of the writers. And then, you know, late at night he would go out with them, and he would kind of spout off about George and players and whatever else. And for the most part, those guys kind of kept that quiet.
I looked at a little excerpt. You know, one of the things, imagine being a sports writer after George Steinbrenner goes off on Hideki Arabu.
Oh, my. Okay?
You have to make sure that you type the correct letters of what he said. Because if you don't put a hashtag in there or something, you know, that could look bad. You know, but what he said was basically just saying that Hideki Arabu was fat.
Right.
But you also had to be careful of the way it came across. And, you know, he just was an owner that spoke his mind. And, you know, at times he paid the price for it and was out of baseball for a little while. But I think it's the edge that the Yankees needed at that time.
Right. And as Mike said, I think the time that George spent away from the team was inevitably what allowed them to kind of, you know, refocus into the second act that he had as owner of the team. And, you know, certainly it's a little bit more of Hal's influence moving forward than it was, you know, the fire and brimstone boss. You know, I always mention this. I'm a couple of years older than you, so I remember the Bronx Zoo when they were, you know, in that area, and then things kind of quieted down, but then they ramped up again with Dave Winfield. It just was such an interesting team, and they continue to be, and they always will.
Yeah, and they've put in a good amount of time and effort into that team, so I think that's good. Again, the book, Bosses of the Bronx, it's a read that you probably want to pick up. You know, if you have Father's Day coming up in June and you're looking for something, you know, buy that book, take a look at it first, then give it to your dad and, you know, see what you think of it.
Yes, Yankee fans and just baseball fans in general, You know, again, we're not getting anything off the back end from Mike, but it sounds like a really, really great book, and I'm very much looking forward to reading it. So when we come back, Cap, on the other side, we're going to talk a little Knicks. You know, interesting playoff series they're having right now with Atlanta, Mets, a little NFL draft, and your calls, hopefully in the second half hour of Sports Talk New York.
Listening to Sports Talk New York. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com. Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to the second half of Sports Talk New York here on 95.9 FM, 1240 AM, WGBB. Once again, our number is 516-623-1240. We'd love to have you call in and talk anything New York sports. Once again, 516-623-1240. Had a great segment with Mike Vaccaro of the New York Post talking about his book on the New York Yankees. And, you know, certainly the Yankees, the big news today, Cap, was that they lost the game. They had been playing so well.
Yeah.
You know, started off a little bit up and down, but then got on a great roll. And, you know, the other baseball team in town is on a different roll at the moment, but we'll kind of hold off on that. But we're going to get into right now, you know, something that obviously basketball is a big topic here on this show for both of us. And, Knicks have tied up the series 2-2 with Atlanta. I don't know if anybody expected the series at this point to be tied 2-2 and the Knicks kind of on the ropes, but, you know, what are your thoughts on what you've seen so far, and have the Knicks really taken control of this series?
Well, first off, our phone lines are open for the last half hour, 516-623-1240. Whether you're listening on the radio or on the app, 95.9 FM, 1240 AM, we are willing to chat anything with you. You want to talk Knicks, Yanks, Mets, NFL draft, we'll talk it with you. But
lacrosse.
Yeah. We'll break it down for you, but at the same time, we want to hear what you want to talk about. So, you know, speaking of the Knicks, I just think that this has been a year where the Knicks have prepped to be healthy and in the right spot in the playoffs to make a run. And for the most part, I thought they were there.
Yes.
The problem with the Knicks has literally been 1 point over two games, mm-hmm. You know, losing a game by 1 point, losing another game by 1 point, and that comes down to just fourth quarter execution. And they put themselves in situation, it's up 14, up 12, up 16, where they just get down the stretch and they can't score. And if you're going to go after Jalen Brunson and maybe double team him, you can't just throw the ball in Mikal Bridges' hands and Josh Hart's hands and think they're going to hit a three-pointer. You got to have other options. And I think that big option is Karl-Anthony Towns. Stepped up with a triple-double the other night, and I think he helped them even the series out. Who's the player that has to step up in 5 and 6 and 7? Again, it doesn't have to be that guy in the fourth quarter, but somebody's got to make an impact early so that you're up enough that that fourth quarter doesn't become a, oh, no, C.J. McCollum's going to take over.
Yeah. You know, when Mike Brown came in, the whole thing was that he was going to play more guys throughout the regular season,
yeah,
so that the superstars were fresh,
yeah,
you know, come playoff time. And I think one thing that's been a theme throughout this year, though, Chris, is that Karl-Anthony Towns has been, if you can say it, underutilized offensively, at least, because, you know, it's easy to say all his numbers are down, but, you know, having the triple-double, he's so capable of that, and the offense, they're not going to be a great defensive team because that's not Mike Brown's thing. You know, Tom Thibodeau, he was a defensive-minded coach, but the offense flowed. There are just times where they look out of sync, And when you're, you know, 85 games into a season, 86 games, how is that even possible?
Yeah, and it just seems like there's not an offensive flow. It's a one-on-one game. And, you know, the fast break is a regular season thing. Once you get to the playoffs, yeah, if you're a fast,
it's half court.
Yeah, it's a half court game. So if you're just hey, we're going to press people or we're going to push the ball when it goes in the basket, you're not going to do it. But you got to have situations down the stretch where you know what you're doing. Now, I thought, and this was all because I was watching the game on TV, or I don't even know if it's on Amazon Prime at that game, the first loss that the Knicks had, I thought when CJ McCollum was at the line that they had a timeout left.
Yeah.
Because they were saying they have another timeout. So I'm thinking, if he makes both, they call a timeout down three and get it, advance the ball to midcourt.
Right.
If he makes one out of two, you call timeout, move it up. Even if he misses both, I'm not going.
No.
With 5 seconds, I'm calling a timeout and advancing the ball.
Absolutely.
And I see them advance the ball, and then I see Mikal Bridges pull up for a pull-up jumper. And I'm going, what happened? So, again, that was a situation where Mike Brown used the timeout probably at some point because he thought the shot clock was winding down with, let's say, 2 minutes to go. You got to be better. He's getting out coached by Quinn Snyder. And that's a problem.
That is
okay?
A problem. Yeah.
Because you brought Mike Brown in here to be better than the problems that Thibodeau had. Okay.
Right.
So that's my first problem. The second thing is, Mikal Bridges got to go to the basket. He is a guy that is afraid of contact. He was always when he was with Brooklyn, and he would just pull up for that jumper. You got to go to the basket and make the ref call a foul there. That's what I'm saying is they need another guy. This is a guy they gave up 5 number one draft picks for. And honestly, he didn't score for a game and a half.
And then he comes out. He doesn't light the world on fire, but at least he looks somewhat like the version of the player that he should be. How is he so up and down?
Yeah, and I think that's just like a streaky guy who wants to be in rhythm. He doesn't want to be the main guy. He wants to be, hey, you know, Jalen hit 2 shots, so they're going to guard him. I'm going to make a shot. But if he's off, you know, you kind of lose him. I just feel defensively they don't have the right lineups in. You know, at the end of the game, I see C.J. McCollum shooting over Deuce McBride. I'm going, what is he matching up for? Now, I know they took out Brunson because they didn't want him in the game at that point, but, like, why is he on him? You got to make sure you have length on him.
Yeah.
And make somebody else beat you. And some of these guys have been good. Johnson has been good for the Hawks. You know, size-wise, I think the one game that they lost, the first game they lost by one, the paint points in the fourth quarter were 22-5. Mike, that's bad.
That is
you
bad.
Can't give up 22 points in one quarter just by guys going to the basket. So I just think they still haven't identified their identity. And that's a problem,
yeah.
You know, because they're a team that to me should have been one of the favorites to make it to the Eastern Conference Finals and the NBA Finals.
Without a doubt.
And after watching the first 3 games, that I thought anything but that.
Yeah. I mean, even if they, let's say they win the next 2 games and go into the next round.
Well, I think that's confidence if
yes,
they do.
Absolutely.
Because that means they won 3 in a row.
Right. Which they should. I mean, against this Atlanta Hawks team, they really should.
They're the better team.
Yes.
But they just don't show it for 48 minutes.
Right. So let's play devil's advocate here and say that the Knicks don't advance to the NBA Finals.
Okay, lose, but win the first round.
Win the first round.
I think Mike Brown could be out. And
yeah,
is that what you're going to ask?
I hate saying that too. Yeah, that is my question. Only because, you know, he came in with a lot of pressure, obviously, to at least repeat what happened last year. Now, if they're getting beat by better teams or out, you know, the lineups on the other teams, but if you're being out executed by the likes of Quinn Snyder or whoever coming forward, that's not a good look.
Yeah, and I don't always put it on coaching, but I think at this point the Knicks have to have the right lineups in and they have to have the right situations down the stretch.
Yeah.
Alvarado, I think for the most part, has been a spark plug. He gives them something. There are games where maybe he's a little bit, you know, a liability out there, but I think they have the right pieces there. The bench can be a little you can't stick in the second quarter and the early fourth quarter with your bench for long periods of time.
Right.
You got to get your guys a little bit of time and then put them back in. And I think sometimes he allows to be bet. Mitch Robinson can be a minus 28 for you, or he can be a plus 10.
Yeah.
And that's not good.
No,
you know, he's got to be a force when he's in the game.
He is such a wild card. You know, there was a stat the other night in the game that the Knicks blew that big lead at home, game 2.
Sure.
In the second quarter and relatively deep into the fourth quarter, They played a lineup that had not played together all season.
And that's where it's like, hey, if you were going to play these guys, you should have tried it another time, not now.
Yeah, if you're looking to get guys minutes in the playoffs, that's not the time to do it.
And I think that comes from assistants, too. Like, you know, the head coach is not the only guy making substitutions.
Right.
You'll see this at the college level. Like, hey, listen, once we get to the four-minute mark, you two are going in every game.
Sure.
You know? But I think there has to be a little more communication.
Well, and let's be truthful about this. You and I have coached enough basketball. We're not NBA coaches. I don't purport myself to be one. But we've coached enough basketball to when you're looking at your group out on the floor, don't you kind of recognize if they've played together throughout the season?
Yeah,
at least at one time?
You know what,
yeah.
What guys have played together,
I mean,
and what guys haven't. But I think, you know, just looking across the board, you're watching the Pistons struggle.
Yeah.
Okay. Against the Magic. You're watching the Celtics not be very sharp. So I think it's kind of in a situation where in the East Coast, it's anybody's game. You could have an 8 seed wind up going to the NBA Finals. That's just my opinion.
All right. Last NBA question before we move on. So last night in the Timberwolves, Nuggets game, at the end of the game, Minnesota's dribbling out the clock, and I'm lost for who it was, but a guy goes in, hits a layup, and Jokic goes and literally grabs him by the throat almost, and it wasn't quite a fight. So I've heard two things about this, that there's absolutely no way that you do that, and that, you know, it's not that big a deal. I have my own thought on it, but I'm curious to think about you.
I didn't see it, so I don't know what the exact situation was, how much you're up, and, you know, how – there was already altercations during the game.
Right.
So I think that's, you know, one of the things where it's like you got to just let it go. But I've seen guys, you know, try to dribble out the clock at half court and guys steal the ball out of their pocket down by 14, and then that guy goes up for a layup and he gets demolished.
Right.
Because they're mad that he's stealing the ball when they were trying to dribble it out.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, it's an unnecessary layup.
Yeah.
Pull the ball out, end the game, and stop with the drama. No need to, you know, I even don't understand why, and the NBA is a little bit different, but if you got 45 seconds to go and you got your subs in, why are you bombing threes 2 seconds into the shot clock?
I know.
You know, just run the clock a little bit more.
Yeah, it's, and I think that's why a lot of purists criticize the NBA, because there's a right way and a wrong way to play, and you disrespect the game.
I think it's a lot to do with how the game is flowing, too. And in the NBA, if you got tees being thrown out, I think Dante DiVincenzo tore his Achilles.
He did.
Ant got hurt, too.
Yeah, he's out now, probably, I mean.
For a while.
Yeah, for a while. And they're up 3-1. I don't know, you know, how that's going to. Now you're down
could
two
affect
starters.
The series, yeah,
yeah, you might turn around on the
but
time
I think
here.
Once there's bad blood there, I think that also changes it. You know, think about a hockey game. You know, a team's down 3-1 with 10 seconds to go, and the team with one goal takes a shot from 75 feet.
Yeah.
If there were five fights earlier in the game, you're realizing that guy's taking a slap shot to try and probably hurt somebody.
Yeah.
In a game that doesn't have that, you know, draw up to it, then maybe that shot is meaningless.
Pull the ball out and don't give people an opportunity for bulletin board material.
Yeah, and you don't
There's
want anybody
no
getting hurt either.
Right, definitely. And these are some big fellas out there. All right, so here we are. According to the clock in the studio, it is 8:44 and 30 seconds. We've held off this long. The New York Mets. It's been approximately a month since we've been in the studio. It was early season. You know, obviously, winning games. They won two the other day to put together this little mini winning streak, but that was obviously overshadowed by the huge losing streak, and today got swept in a doubleheader by the Colorado Rockies. I asked you this question the other night, and you had a very quick answer. Is there anything that can be done with this team?
No.
Like,
honestly, you're throwing different lineups out there. Same stuff's happening.
Right.
You're throwing different pitchers out there. Same things are happening.
Yeah.
You're trying to move guys up and down in the lineup. Nothing seems to happen. At this point, Mike, the reality is this is not a bad team. This is a horrendous baseball team. And I'm going to say this even more specifically. This is a horrendous offensive baseball team. The guys cannot hit the ball. And then the guys who are supposed to be playing defense and preventing runs are in playing positions that they've never played before, Mike. You got guys out there who are not supposed to be left fielders, third baseman, first baseman, and you are expected to prevent runs? It's not happening. No. Watching a ball get thrown all over, kicked all over, and it's really bad.
I mean, did David Stearns really think that everyone would buy his claim of the, and we're doing a lot of air quotes here, preventing runs?
I think people did. Ugh. I don't understand it, though, because if you were doing that, then tell me what you did to put a better defensive team on the field in order to help you win games.
Right.
You know? You know, they wanted to go out there and eliminate themselves from certain things. I'm going to throw some numbers out there, see where you fit. Batting average for team out of 30 teams in the major leagues, where do you think the Mets are? I want you to be within like two or three.
All right. I'm going to say 27.
Okay. You're within two. They're batting 230. They're a 25th in the major leagues. Okay.
230 total?
230. You only have the Twins, Angels, White Sox, Phillies, and Reds behind them. Phillies have been horrible too.
They have.
Okay. Home runs.
Okay. Out of 30?
Yes.
Oh, boy. I would say they got to be in the bottom third. I'll say 22nd.
Well, I'll tell you this much. Their leading home run guy is Francisco Alvarez with four, which leaves him as the 60th highest home run.
All right, maybe 30th then.
The Mets are 26. They have 19 homers.
Wow.
Okay, there's only two other teams with less than them, the Red Sox and the Giants. 19 homers. Murakami, a guy they didn't even want to go after, has 11 himself.
Yeah.
We didn't want to go after him. OPS.
Again, 25, 26.
They're dead last.
Dead last.
And, Mike, it's not even close. They're 636. The next highest is 663.
Oh, man.
They're like 40 points away. It is really bad. Slugging percentage, where do you think they are?
Well, if they're so bad in homers, the slugging percentage has got to be 28.
Dead last. 344 slugging.
Wow.
On base percentage, because now if you get on base, maybe you could do something, right? Mike, dead last, 292. They're not even getting on base 30% of the time. Their hitting is fifth worst. Everything else is dead last.
Now, I know that, you're going to look at me a little funny here. Juan Soto being out impacted that somehow.
Okay.
But not to the, I mean, if he had been even his normal self, would these numbers be dramatically better?
Well, he's going to get walks if he's there.
Yes.
He's going to walk. They're just not going to pitch to him. Mike, RBIs, dead last, 85. Runs scored, dead last. Okay? They're not even driving runs in. There's only four teams that have under 100 RBIs. We have 85. I'm sorry to put the we on this, but it's attacking Mets fans' lives.
It is.
They are literally just every day seeing the same thing.
Right.
To get swept by the Colorado Rockies, to get swept by the Dodgers, to get swept by the Cubs, to get swept by the two out of three by the Arizona Diamondbacks. I think before they left, they got swept by another team.
Yeah.
Mike, it's sweep after sweep after sweep. When they go out there, even if they're up 3-1 in the fourth, it's not going to happen. Yeah. One of the things I couldn't find today is runs that they gave up in the sixth inning. It always seems like their starting pitcher in the sixth inning hits a wall and they give up way too many.
It's almost hard to believe that it's April 26th and there's literally no reason to even think about going to games.
Mike,
I mean, it's April 26th.
You know how hard it is to be 10 games under 500 after 28 games? It's very difficult.
That's
what happens when you go on a 12-game losing streak.
Yeah.
And, Mike, they've lost 15 out of 17 now. There is no hope in sight. It's not like, oh, tomorrow Juan Soto is playing. Well, he's played for the last few days,
right.
And that doesn't change anything. Oh, well, Francisco Lindor's, we had one day of them playing together, the two of them.
Forget identity. I mean, because if you're asking what this team's identity is now, it's just losing mentality. But what did David Stearns think with all these wholesale changes that the team's identity was going to be and not a run-preventing team? I mean, what did... Again, whether you like Pete Alonso, whether you like anybody Jeff McNeil,
Brandon Nimmo,
who's killing it, and he's probably like, thank goodness I'm out. But Pete's not off to a great start, and McNeil is struggling.
No, he's not.
Yeah, but Nimmo, if you get rid of that many core guys, and bring in a guy that is supposed to play first base, who doesn't play first base.
Correct. And then another guy who got hurt, right, who was supposed to play first base.
And starting pitching, Senga is horrendous, which, you know, is unfortunate. But
Peterson doesn't know his left from his right.
He doesn't know anything. Manaea, he's terrible. I mean, what? Everything that could go wrong has gone wrong, but what did they think was going to happen?
I think they thought Bo Bichette was going to be an RISP machine. Runners in scoring position. But they don't even have guys in runners in scoring position. He had a triple the other night, but otherwise he hasn't been doing it. Maybe they thought they were going to catch lightning in a bottle with, you know, a guy who was going to play first base who had never played first base before. He's injured all the time. I think they were trying to give guys like Brett Beatty a chance. Now, here's my thing. Neither one of them is good.
No.
Vientos or Beatty, neither one of them is a good baseball player. And I mean baseball player. Hitter, fielder, all of that stuff. They're just not good, Mike.
No.
And we're going to keep holding on to that thought. Carson Benge is a little young, and I think if you let him play every day, he'll get over 200. He'll get you some homers. He'll get you stolen bases. But he probably shouldn't be up in the major leagues at this point.
No.
If you let Ronnie Mauricio play every day, he'll give you a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't. Marcus Semien is not an all-star baseball player. You know, they brought him in only because, well, a couple of reasons. You know, we can get into some of the politics of it. But they brought him in because he had one less year on his contract, and they didn't want to be with Nimmo's fourth or fifth more year where they can get rid of Semien after three. Mike, he's not going to hit home runs.
No.
He's got warning track power. He's a decent to above-average second baseman.
Right.
But not as a hitter.
No.
He's not going to bat 230 this year.
And you would think of a guy in Semien that has been in around the league so long and, you know, knows the game. And he made a base running error the other night on he tagged up on and wasn't able to score on an obvious ball that hit the wall practically.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he just misread it, and you could see he was embarrassed.
Yeah. See, last year, Mike, I was pissed at the third base coach for not sending a guy in a September night, right?
Yes.
That means nothing now.
Right, yeah.
You know, like, who cares if Mark Vientos runs through a stop sign? This team is still terrible. Somebody said, well, what if the Mets were to win today? They're still really bad. They just didn't get swept by the Rockies if they win today.
I mean, if they win 8 of the next 10, they're still they're nowhere near first place.
So for 1 minute, let's just have this debate. The Mets lost 12 in a row, but when they were at, like, 10,
mm-hmm.
I was listening to some of the sports talk and also just having the water cooler chat.
Yeah.
Is it better for the Mets to continue to lose or to win one random game in there and then lose like another six more? And I'm just talking like PR-wise.
Mm-hmm.
You work for the Mets. You're trying to get people to come out to that game that night.
Yes.
This could be the night that the Mets win. And then it doesn't. This could be the night. And we're at 19, and we're at 26, and you could be at the game where they set the record and lose 29 in a row. I think it would have been better for the Mets to just go totally, totally horrible in a historic way, as opposed to just 15 out of 17, 19 out of 23. Lose 24 in a row. Be the worst team in Major League Baseball history consecutively.
Okay.
Just get it over with.
All right. I disagree.
Okay.
And this is not made up. I disagree because I think the impact of that on the long term would just be devastating for the entire season. I understand what you're saying. It does, in a morbid kind of way, it generates some juice like, hey, tonight's the night. I just think that it's from a PR standpoint, it's just, you know, a debacle. It would be horrible. But if you're going to lose, I mean, I understand what you're saying. You might as well do it in an interesting fashion, because there's nothing interesting about, you know, going 18 innings against the Colorado Rockies, scoring one run and making their pitching staff look like the second coming of you know, the Orioles in the 70s.
For those of you that are looking for a cold night to go watch a game, Tuesday night the Mets are going to play the up-and-coming Washington Nationals.
Oh, boy.
And we have a video tribute coming up. You know who that video tribute's going to be for? Dickie Lovelady is now a Washington National. I think he deserves a tribute.
Oh.
I mean, think about what the Mets are throwing out there at you. You know?
Yeah.
Like, we have Carl Edwards Jr.
Yeah.
You know?
Isn't that a place where you get
That's where you
burgers?
Get a burger.
Yeah. Yeah, and he actually looked decent today.
Of course. Austin Warren the other night's getting MVP chance.
Oh, my God.
Because Devin Williams can't get anybody out, and after the game, he talks like he doesn't care. He doesn't care.
All right. So in the remaining couple minutes we have, I obviously you have to address the manager. Now, you can I want to come at it from
what
a different...
What does it take to get rid of him,
right,
though?
I want to come at it from one standpoint that I'm interested to hear what you have to say.
Okay.
So the other night, when they did finally, win a game, Brazoban pitches the eighth. Okay. And comes out for the ninth while Devin Williams is running in with the, and he steps over the line, so
he has to pitch
to a batter.
Yeah.
Who are we blaming on that? In Little League, you tell guys.
You heard the story, right?
I didn't.
He supposedly told Brazoban, if we're tied, you're going out there. If we take the lead, Devin Williams is going out there.
Okay.
But all he heard was the first part. That you're going out there, you know? He goes, but I speak Spanish. I should have gone to him. This is Mendoza. I speak Spanish. I should have gone to him and told him exactly the situation. Then after the game, he's talking through the translator, Alan Serio, and he's laughing about it. He goes, well, when did you figure out that you weren't supposed to be out there? He goes, when I go on the mound and I hear this music.
Jeez.
But they can't even get that right. Then
it's so embarrassing.
But, Mike, it's even worse. He gets the first guy out. Now it's no longer a safe situation.
Yeah.
Why not keep him in the game
exactly
until a guy gets on base? Because then the tying run would have been in the on-deck circle. It would have been a safe situation. So now Devin Williams has second and third. The tying run's at second. We're about to blow this game.
You could see him, Williams, as he turned around to go back into the bullpen.
He's like, what am I got myself into?
Yeah, his body language was like, are you kidding me?
Yeah. I mean, it's just they can't even get pitching changes right.
All right. So we have a day off tomorrow. Who's managing the team on Tuesday?
My answer is Andy Green. Okay. Andy Green is a minor league roving instructor, basically, for the Mets. He has managed the Diamondbacks at some point.
Okay.
People talk about, you know, the guy, Kai Correa, I think he needs time to be the bench coach. You know, he hasn't been a manager yet. People say Carlos Beltran. How can you retire a guy's number when the team is 40 games under 500?
Yeah.
They're going to boo him when they're retiring his number. So it cannot be Carlos Beltran, at least not this year.
No.
I honestly, Mike, how can you put Carlos Mendoza in that dugout again? You can't.
Yeah, I don't think you can. Whether anyone believes it's his fault or not, there's just, you know, and I'm not for change for change's sake.
It's been too long.
But yeah,
he should have been out at the end of last year. Because, Mike, think about it this way. I know we're going to end this.
Take all his coaches away and then put him back.
Yes, you took all his coaches away. But it is the same story as last year. People are like, oh, it's not the same. It's the same story. Every time you think they're going to come out of it, they're not.
No.
I think in the last 162 games, the Mets are about 62-100. If you go back to last year,
that's
they are really, really bad.
Yeah,
and you know you just got to blow it up and just say, hey, at this point, guys are going to have to go. You know how like they brought in Robinson Cano at one point, and
yes,
then they finally said it's time to go. Mm-hmm. You may have to do that with a player or two.
Yeah, it's certainly. Unfortunately, who thought that we would be talking like this? And it's not even May yet, but I agree with you. I don't think there's anything other right now than just to restock, retool, decide, you know, who you want to keep, who you don't. And, you know, I'm hoping, I was very happy about Bo Bichette. You know, his baseball card says what he's going to be, but boy, you mentioned he sat in the dugout after the game today. It's pretty low.
Yep. Well, hopefully we'll see you back in a couple weeks, Mother's Day. And
yes.
We're talking more positive.
Let's hope so. Thanks to Mike Vaccaro and, everybody go out and get his book. Thanks to Brian Graves behind the glass. And you know, you folks out there, pray for us too, Met fans. But we'll talk a little NFL draft next time and everything New York sports. Hopefully the Knicks are in the second round. Have a great 2 weeks, and we'll see you soon.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.